But Happy New Year, hey? Happy New Year. A little bit belated, I know that, as we've been away for the last couple of Sundays. Happy New Year. I hope your new year has kicked off well. And we're kicking off this year at church with these 3 weeks in Matthew chapter 8, reflecting on King Jesus, because I think this is a wonderful way for us to pause and recalibrate our vision as we head into the new year. It's also a really lovely link back to Christmas, just those few weeks ago when we met this Jesus, born as a baby in humble circumstance, and Matthew told us, well, this babe is God's great king. So we're going to spend 3 weeks reflecting on how Matthew, in this chapter 8 of his gospel, paints a picture of who this baby grew into, the man Jesus. We will be coming back to the Gospel of Matthew in term 4 to carry on from chapters 9 onwards. But we thought actually at the start of the year to be able to frame our perspective on this year ahead, intentionally fixing our eyes on Jesus, hearing his words, seeing him at work, getting a glimpse of his heart. In this one chapter over these 3 weeks, we're going to see Matthew highlight three really significant aspects of Jesus: his profound authority, his humble service, and his generous salvation. And in the months that follow, term one, we're going to open up the book of Colossians, see how all of that plays out, that Jesus is the supreme king. What does that look like for life together as God's people and in the world? And we're going to unpack a whole bunch of different things across the course of the year in different parts of the word. But wonderful to be able to look at Jesus in very simple ways as we begin the year. And over the course of these 3 weeks, I want us to begin the year reflecting on one simple question. How shall I live with Jesus my King this year? We're going to come back to that same question each week as we're here in Matthew chapter 8. How shall I live with Jesus my King this year? And today we're reflecting on the profound authority of Jesus that Matthew sets out before us. And I don't know about you, but authority isn't something that we sit easily with. It's not a very trendy topic, and it's probably not something we're excited to spend our Sunday mornings talking about, but we can all see the news and we know how contentious authority is. And I hope that we'll come away from this deeply challenged to consider how we might live differently in 2026 in light of what we learn about Jesus' authority here. But as challenging as the idea of authority can be, I hope that we come away with much more than just being challenged. As much as we come away challenged by what we learn, I'm hoping that we'll also be comforted and actually even energized for the year ahead. And I wonder if you think comforted, energized. That's not exactly what I would consider when I'm hearing about someone in authority. You might be surprised to consider that Jesus' authority can be a great comfort, that it would actually be an energizing force for your year ahead. And I hope that you're able to tap into that sense of surprise, not like, whoa, I've just been totally blown away surprise, but that kind of quirky little, huh, hadn't thought of it that way. Because I reckon that sense of surprise is actually what Matthew had in mind for us as he wrote this for us. So please make sure that you've got Matthew chapter 8 open there in front of you, because on my count, almost every verse of what Bree just read for us has an element of surprise for us. We're not going to unpack them all. Some of them you might not have noticed because you've read this passage many times and you're like, oh yeah, that happened. Yeah, I knew about that too. Other times, perhaps this is the first time you've heard this, but there are elements of this that don't strike us as surprising because we're not seeing them through the lens of those that Matthew originally wrote this to and those that originally heard these words from Jesus. So we're going to make our way through in a very simple way and see some of the surprises that Matthew puts before us. And so Matthew chapter 8 begins, when Jesus came down from the mountainside, large crowds followed him. And now the first thing we should ask is, well, what mountain is Matthew referring to? He doesn't actually give us any sort of geological, geographical location. That doesn't seem to be important to him. But Matthew is clearly referring to the chapters that he's recorded through what we know as Matthew chapter 5, 6 and 7. Because that's what's commonly referred to as Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. And back at chapter 5 verse 1, we read that Jesus saw the crowds and he went up onto the mountain. He saw these people coming from all over the region, and so he gathered with them to teach them. And that's what the next three chapters unpack. So at the start of chapter 8, well, Matthew gives us the context. This is Jesus coming down from that mountainside. He's wrapped up that block of teaching, and Matthew sets the scene in chapter 8 with this link. Having wrapped up all that he said there, Jesus came down from the mountain and large crowds followed him. And we might not be very surprised about that, because large crowds had followed him up there, so of course, why will not stick with him now? But on the other hand, if we were to consider what Jesus has said in that teaching, there is something that's kind of surprising about this. Because Jesus has not been saying things that are easy to hear. He's spoken very frankly about personal conduct and ethics and our priorities and responsibilities in life. He's said some very challenging things about our anxieties and our priorities in life. He's had some pretty unsettling things to say about where we can be confident or perhaps not so confident of our relationship with God. And in the final paragraphs that Matthew records for us, in the things that would be ringing in our ears if we had just read Matthew chapter 7, Jesus has made the bold claim that if you build your life on him and his teaching, then you will survive the coming judgment of God and enter into eternal life in the kingdom of heaven. And that right there, like, that is the kind of claim that marks Jesus either as a fraud or a madman, or maybe some sort of complex mix of both, that he would be so bold as to say he is that one. So I think, as easy as it is for us to pick up Matthew chapter 8 and just read it and go, ho-hum, there's actually something kind of surprising that Matthew wants us to see as this chapter begins, that any crowds follow Jesus at all. Surely we'd expect him with that kind of claim to just be written off as a fraud or some crazy man. But there must have been something about Jesus that captured the attention of the crowds. That they'd heard all of this, and yet they still followed him. They wanted more. And I think that ought to prompt us to consider him carefully too. If you're here today considering him for yourself, perhaps for the first time, as I've said, we are so glad that you're with us. We're so glad that you're checking him out. We would love to hear your impressions, to hear your questions, because it would make plenty of sense to have lots of questions. We shouldn't read the things that tumble out of Jesus' mouth and just go, hey. There is nothing ordinary about it. In some ways, it is pretty surprising that people gave Jesus a hearing at all. But we are, of course, totally convinced that he is completely worth hearing out. So, with the crowds following him, a man with leprosy came and knelt before him. That is the next thing that Matthew tells us. And this is totally surprising. Perhaps not to us, absolutely to the people that Matthew was writing to and the people that were there with Jesus. This is totally surprising. Because in this time and culture, a person with leprosy was expected to keep their distance. According to both, you know, religious practice, cultural expectations, people with the kinds of skin conditions kind of captured by this term leprosy, they were considered unclean. And by coming close, they risked contaminating others with their uncleanness. So it is very surprising that this man approaches Jesus. What could explain him doing something so unexpected, even so unacceptable as this? Well, Matthew makes it clear it's his confidence in Jesus. Lord, if you're willing, he says, you can make me clean. What a beautiful picture of faith in the authority of Jesus. Because in that time and place, in the thought world of that man, suffering as he was with this condition that put him on the outside of society, in that thought world, that man's skin condition rendered him unclean, and no one could change that. As long as his skin condition persisted, that was his state of life. Now, some of you who were here with us last year might remember that we studied Leviticus. You might even remember, preacher is hopeful here, that in the context of Leviticus, we actually heard a lot about being clean and unclean and the impact of such things as leprosy and other skin diseases and a whole bunch of other things. We read about provisions that the priests had for rituals in the tabernacle, for a variety of rituals of cleansing. But they were only of any use after the condition had resolved. They could only declare someone clean to confirm what's already taken place. Yes, the condition has resolved. They would never make someone clean, take away the cause of their uncleanness. If you want to sort of jog your memory, or perhaps listen to it for the first time, you can jump on our website, pull up the podcast on Leviticus. Week 3 in that series in particular helps us unpack this. And there might be some benefit to that, because I am convinced as I spend this time in Matthew's gospel that Matthew has that whole worldview at the front of his mind as he walks with us, with Jesus, through Matthew 8, especially Matthew 8 through 10. That's very much at the forefront of his mind. But here, this man doesn't come to Jesus and say, my leprosy has gone away and now you can declare me to be clean, as if he sort of thinks Jesus is sort of filling the role of the priests in some way. No, he asks for something much greater. If you will, you have the power to make me clean. He's confident in Jesus' authority to do something much more than just confirm what is the case. And if we've read Matthew chapter 4, just before he went up on the mountain to teach, then we're not surprised to hear that Jesus is indeed willing and able to heal him, which he does. So what is surprising about verse 3 as this man interacts with Jesus? In verse 3, Jesus reached out his hand and he touched the man. I am willing, he said, be clean. Immediately he was cleansed of his leprosy. If we've been reading with Matthew, we're not surprised to hear that Jesus is willing and Jesus is able and immediately he's healed. But Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. That's outrageous. That's jarring. That's surprising if this is the world that we live in. Because every person in that crowd is working so hard to keep their distance. Whoa, what's he doing here? Like, back up, back up, back up. Don't go near him. This man is to them a walking expression of the curse of sin and death. That where he goes, whatever he touches, whoever he interacts with will be contaminated by its stain. So keep clear, or you too will be unclean. But Jesus reached out. Jesus stretched out his hand to touch him. And instead of the contagion running this way and Jesus being contaminated by him and the stain of the curse of sin and death coming upon Jesus as well, the contagion runs the other way. This man's leprosy is rendered clean immediately because this is who Jesus is. This babe born in the manger, God's great king, come to us. He is the one with the power and the authority to bring life. Jesus comes with the authority to dispel the power of the curse. He is a walking fountain of cleansing power. And the surprise here is not simply Jesus' ability to miraculously heal. That's pretty amazing. But it's his ability to overcome the very forces of death that this man's uncleanness represented. And I think that begs the question for us. You know, Matthew just says it, so matter of fact, so easy to gloss over. But it begs the question, how will we respond to a man of such authority, to Jesus? Will you doubt his authority? As if he has any authority in the first place? Yeah, not so convinced of that. I'll sit in the category of doubt. Or will you dismiss his authority as if his authority has anything to do with you? Yeah, sure, like he might, you know, have been quite significant, but what's that to me? Or will you depend on his authority, as this man does? Matthew has set out chapter upon chapter of Jesus' authoritative teaching, and now we see this man come and place his life in Jesus' powerful hands. Will you depend upon his authority this coming year? Well, to help us wrestle with that question, Matthew takes us straight into another encounter that is all about Jesus' authority, and it is just as full of surprises, too many, in fact, that we can't pick them all out. We would literally be going through kind of half verse by half verse to go, wow, that's surprising, that's surprising. We're not going to pick them all out. But this time, it's not a powerless social outcast who comes to Jesus. The surprise here is that it's a centurion. Now, a crash course in ancient history is a little bit helpful to get the point here. The title centurion refers to a commander, a commanding officer in the Roman military who had charge of a large deployment of soldiers. We might recognise the idea of cent equaling 100, like a century is when you score 100 runs in cricket. There are 100 cents in the dollar. Nominally, the centurion had oversight of 100 soldiers, but it was a nominal figure and was often more than that. It represented to the local regional deployment. And that means he is very well established in the ranks of authority, with other officers under him who did what he told them, and actually only a few layers of hierarchy above him before it all gets up to the pointy end of the emperor, Caesar himself. And so there are two main conclusions to take from this surprising fact. A centurion comes to Jesus. First, this man gets what it means to sit under authority and to wield it, and he comes to Jesus. And secondly, he was almost certainly a Gentile, a non-Jew. You can take that for granted. So this is surprising on multiple accounts because this isn't just the weak and the marginalized coming to Jesus. This is a man of significant social standing and power. But at the same time, he's not actually from Jesus' people. This centurion, he's the occupier. He is an agent of the empire. He is a tool of oppression. He is privileged on so many fronts. He's a man of power with great social standing, and yet he has no real claim on Jesus. He can't say, hey, brother, because they're not brothers. But he still comes to Jesus asking for help. Lord, my servant lies at home, paralyzed, suffering terribly. Now, I mean, we might not see that as a question. It's kind of a statement, right? In a culture that is less direct than ours, this is the respectful, the deferential way to ask for help. He doesn't even have the pride, the arrogance to come and say to Jesus, hey, I need you to do something for me. Go do it. No, he comes with great deference and respect. Lord, my servant lies at home, paralyzed, suffering terribly. He places the ball in Jesus' court. Here's some information. How might you choose to respond? The problem is clear. Whatever the diagnosis is that this servant has, it's a picture of a terrible physical suffering, and the centurion asked Jesus for help. And so we come to the surprise in verse 8. He says to Jesus, when Jesus has expressed a willingness to help, he says, Lord, I don't deserve to have you come under my roof. And we need to remember again, this centurion, he would have been one of the most respected, powerful members of the community, honoured by those who honoured Rome, feared by those who hated Rome, but by any measure of the social ladder, he was miles above Jesus. So, it's surprising that he would say, I am not worthy to have you come to me. And perhaps he's acknowledging that Jesus is a Jew, and he is a Gentile, that Jesus would be rendered ceremonially unclean if he came into the Gentile house. Matthew's put before us the idea of the leper and his uncleanness. It would actually be a bit surprising for a Roman centurion to care much about this, maybe to even know much about it. That would reflect a surprising respect for Jewish customs. But in Luke's account of this same story, in Luke's gospel as he recounts this event, he actually highlights exactly that point. This is a Roman centurion with great respect for the Jewish people and their customs. So it may well be a surprising deference to Jesus on two fronts. As a man of great authority, somehow he sees that Jesus is even more worthy than he. And as a Roman occupying and oppressing this local people, somehow he sees Jesus as a man worthy of respect, as a leader of these people. But Matthew's focus is on the man's surprising appreciation of the authority that Jesus has. Lord, he says to Jesus, a centurion who could only rightly name Caesar as Lord, Matthew tells us twice. He comes to Jesus, Lord, I don't deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. It's like he is saying, Jesus, you totally outrank me. I don't deserve to have you come to my house, but also you don't need to come. Because you and I, we both know how commands work. You know how authority works. You have the authority to get this done with just a word. This centurion, he gets how commands work. He's giving them all the time. He's receiving them occasionally, and they are always done. But this isn't just telling people what to do. That's what he does. Bosses people around. Yet this man recognized that Jesus has an even more profound authority, that with a word spoken from a distance, he can command a change in a person's health. Somehow this Roman centurion has recognized in Jesus the authority to stop the suffering of sickness and even the death that would follow. And I think that should surprise us, because it seems that it surprised Jesus. In verse 10, Jesus was amazed, Matthew tells us. Truly, I tell you, I've not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. Now, actually, in truth, it's not quite accurate to say that Jesus is surprised in the sense that he was caught by surprise. He didn't see this coming. Whoa, what happened there? As if it was unexpected. Matthew tells us that Jesus was amazed. And he was amazed in the contrast. Amazed, even capturing in the word of sort of a joyful wonder, amazed. Because it hints that there is something quite surprising about this from a worldly perspective. Because this man comes from the outside. Despite all his worldly power, he humbly acknowledges Jesus' authority. He demonstrates his faith in Jesus' authority from a position of great social standing where there was absolutely no social kudos, no gain for him to be coming to this Jewish teacher to help not his own condition, but actually just one of his many servants. He's come from the outside with profound humility before the authority of Jesus. And perhaps this is the final surprise in the encounter. Jesus says that this is a great example of faith. And it's the kind of faith that has a bearing on this man's eternal future. Jesus says it will be on the basis of how people respond to his authority that they will either enjoy the eternal blessings of God or not. Jesus describes it as an invitation to a lavish banquet. The feast of the kingdom of heaven is the phrase that he used, and it's truly wonderful. What he's doing here is he's drawing on this incredibly rich imagery from the Old Testament. So many of the prophets had pictured it this way. A feast in the kingdom of heaven that is this rich and kind of overflowing image of decadence and enjoyment and festivity and relationship. And Jesus implies that anyone who, like this centurion, will humbly bend the knee to his authority, well, they're gladly welcomed in. And it's an invitation that is generously made available to all. Jesus says that many will come from the east and the west, people from all kinds of backgrounds, ethnically, socially, financially. It's open to anyone who will submit to his authority. But that's the kicker, right? Because it depends on whether we will acknowledge the authority of Jesus. I wonder if you've ever thought of this as a definition of the Christian faith, of faith in Jesus. Depending on him as the one with authority to overcome the forces of death. That faith is leaning into Jesus as the one who is both willing and able to do it for us. If not yet a Christian, I think that there is a pretty great insight into what it means to be a Christian. It's obviously not all that needs to be said, There's so much more to flesh out and to unpack and to understand. But perhaps it is the most basic thing that needs to be said. That faith in Jesus is trusting that he is the one with the authority to overcome the forces of death. And that ought to be challenging for us. Because it means that Jesus actually sits on the throne over all things. And he deserves to sit, he needs to sit on the throne of authority in each of our lives. I think one of the main reasons that we are uncomfortable talking about authority is because we all want to sit on that throne ourselves. So many of the debates that we have about how it plays out culturally reflect a deep both insecurity and protectiveness that we have of our own ability to sit on the throne of authority in our own lives. But it means that we need Jesus to sit on that throne. We need to get down from that throne and acknowledge the authority that he has over our lives too. I think this is particularly significant if you're a young person. You've grown up in the church. You've sort of sat alongside mum and dad. You've heard the stuff at youth group or Sunday school. It's true whether we're young or old. But I think particularly as we work out what it means to be, you know, holding the keys to the car, in the driving seat of my life, making the decisions for what will lie ahead, this is the key question. Whether you're going to acknowledge the great authority that Jesus has over your life. Now, I say that to the young people, but I hope every less young person is also seeing just how plainly that plays out in our own lives too. I mean, I find myself challenged. The phrase that came to mind for me was to keep rededicating myself to the lordship of Jesus, the authority of Jesus in my own life for this year ahead. That was the word that came to mind, rededicating myself to that. Not in the way that I sort of somehow fear that, gosh, as I look back on 2025, gee, I've really wandered from that. Like, it's not a in-out kind of hot coal, but just that gradual process of saying, yeah, I want to rededicate myself to the lordship of Jesus in my life, to keep, if you like the phrase, to keep affirming my allegiance to him. And a new year gives the opportunity to reflect on what it looks like for me to keep depending on his authority as I submit to him as Lord. And as challenging as it is, I think it's also the delight of knowing that I submit my life to the authority of the one who exercises his power for my good in a way that I could never accomplish in my own strength. It's knowing that Jesus' authority is also wonderfully comforting because he's the one who uses his power to bring life to others. Unlike all other authority in its various forms that we see in this world, Jesus is the one who is perfectly secure in his perfect power. He has no need to bolster his credentials or further his own self-interest. He delights to use his authority for the good of others. For the leper cast out by society, Jesus is not only able but willing to help him. In love, Jesus reaches out and touches the untouchable. Jesus uses his power to cleanse and restore. For the centurion, the generosity is no less, and perhaps it's even greater in this surprising way, because in the eyes of the world, this guy was completely opposed to God's kingdom. First, by birth, he's a Gentile, he's outside the people of God, and then by occupation. What's he do for a living? He's a Roman soldier, a tool of oppression over the people of God, and yet Jesus says that by his faith in Jesus, his submission to his authority, he would be among those welcomed into the heavenly banquet, sitting beside the great fathers of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, an inheritor in the promise of God that was to bless all the people of the world. And this is the comfort in knowing Jesus' profound authority. It's the comfort in knowing that however others might view you, this is how the great King of all kings sees you. That in love, he sees you as the one that he can deploy his power to save, to restore, to bless. That's how he sees you. And if that's how my king sees me, well, throw your worst at me. Because flowing out of that, I hope we can see how wonderfully energizing it is to live under the authority of mighty King Jesus. Because he says that if we joyfully bend the knee to him, then we are included in his mighty kingdom work. We become partners in his work of overcoming the forces of death. We're empowered for a life of purpose and direction as the people of the King. I find that it is in knowing the profound authority of Jesus that I am energized to reflect him more fully in all of life. And if you want to think, hey, I wonder if this is a theme that runs through Matthew's gospel, just jump to the very end of it. What does Jesus say to his disciples in the final words that Matthew records for us, him saying, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me," Jesus says, King of all kings. Go therefore, be energized, be empowered, be on about the things that he is on about, and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit and teaching them everything that I've taught you. And what will he do? He'll be with us always. Could there be anything more empowering? But friends, that's enough from me, because I wonder what has struck you from these opening paragraphs of Matthew chapter 8. Can I invite the band to come forward at this point? You're going to help us out by getting us ready to sing in response to some of what we've heard. But as they come forward, I actually want to give the opportunity, they're blessing all of us by creating the opportunity for us just to take a minute now to ponder the things that we've read. And I want to ask you, ask yourself that question that I posed earlier: how shall I live with Jesus my King this year? Just take a minute in silence now. Perhaps there's something that has stood out from you from our time together, a challenge, a comfort, something that energizes you, or perhaps a little like the crowds right at the beginning, you've just got questions and you want to know more and you want to hear more and see more of this Jesus. What has stood out for you that might play into that question? How shall I live with Jesus my King this year? We're going to take a minute in silence, and then I'll give a nod to the band and they'll invite us to stand and sing in a wonderful way that gives us opportunity to respond to that question.